from Chicago Public Radio. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. The selection of a gay bishop by the Episcopal Church in the United States has some church members and clergy so distressed that they are considering splitting off and forming their own church within the larger Anglican Communion. Schisms are, of course, not unknown to Christianity. The Anglican Church, of which American Episcopalians are a part, was itself born of a schism between the Pope and Henry VIII. The wider Protestant Reformation cleaved off several new denominations from Catholicism. And before any of that, there was the divide between the Western and Eastern Orthodox versions of Christianity. So, while schisms are not new, they have been traumatic and sometimes even bloody. Now, the Episcopalians are hardly likely to shed blood over their new bishop, but that doesn't mean that a split couldn't have serious repercussions. And there are other Christian denominations that are also facing divisions, or at least strife, over issues like homosexual unions and gay clergy. Are the potential fractures within Christianity today comparable to the splits that have fragmented Christianity in the past? And what would such splits mean for Christianity as a world religion in the 21st century? Today on Odyssey, we are going to take a look at the contexts, both historical and contemporary, in which the current debates within Christianity are taking place. Joining us for the conversation is Lamin Sane, who is the author of the forthcoming book, Whose Religion is Christianity? The Gospel Beyond the West. He's joining us from the campus of Yale University. From Atlanta, Georgia, we are joined by John Witte, who is the author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in the Western Tradition. John Witte, let me ask you to begin our conversation. The issue that threatens to divide Episcopalians now, the issue of a gay bishop, how does that compare with issues that have created or generated schisms in the past?
Well, certainly issues of marriage and family have been important parts of reform movements and sometimes important parts of schisms that have developed in the church, and you've mentioned them briefly in your opening comments. The doctrinal issue of marriage and family is not of the same order of magnitude as issues like justification by faith alone or infant baptism or papal infallibility that have been deeply divisive within Western Christianity. But marriage, family, and sexuality have been controversial issues that often provide wedges between splintering and sometimes schismatic groups. In the 12th and 13th century, consolidation of the church's sacramental theology of marriage and the emergence of its canon law of marriage was of a cardinal piece to the church's consolidation of its power within Western Christendom and the expansion of canon law as the one international law, the pan-European law, that was the subject of much papal and conciliar legislation and a variety of cases from the 12th to the 15th century. In the 16th century, the Lutheran Reformation broke out over a number of theological issues, a very important one of which was marriage and family. The attack that the Lutheran reformers, Luther himself and a variety of theologians and jurists working with him, mounted was against the sacramental theology of marriage and against the notion of marriage being inferior to the celibate or chaste life, and also the abuses that had crept into the monastic institutions and to the administration of the canon laws of marriage. Luther and his followers in parts of the Holy Roman Empire, Scandinavia, Austria, Switzerland, made marriage reform a very important part of the first wave of reforms, and marriage ordinances became very important symbolic acts and strategic acts for newly reformed communities to put in place. And as you indicated, the controversy over marriage and a technical issue of impediments was at the heart of the dispute between Henry VIII and the papacy, and ultimately led to the schism between the Church of England and the Catholic Church on the continent. And subsequently, issues of marriage and family have not divided denominations along these same kind of macro lines, but they have been issues that have splintered discrete Protestant denominations and certainly have some divided individual parishes and churches. And the case law in both England and America is rife with cases that ultimately come to secular courts for resolution that start with a controversy about a local priest or a parson or a minister marrying somebody improperly or being involved in an improper marriage himself.
So, Lamin Saneh, if history suggests that the kind of concerns that American Christians are dealing with now are not petty, in other words, that they're important issues that have occupied Christians for a long time, I wonder how the divisions in the United States look from the perspective of Christians elsewhere in the world today.
Well, I think there is a tremendous gap, cultural gap, between the West and the non-Western world. This came out of the Lambeth Conference, which is a 10-year Anglican World Conference in London, where matters of life and worship and doctrine and faith are discussed. And at the last Lambeth Conference, this was a major dividing line between the Western bishops and the Third World bishops. They have different issues that they were concerned with, and in fact at Lambeth, the African and the Asian bishops and the others did not want to debate the issue of gay and homosexual rights. It was sort of, they felt that the issue was dragged into the conference against their will.
So they're just uninterested in it?
Well, they have other issues that are really life and death issues for them in the non-Western world. Issues, for example, of poverty, issues of relations with the Muslims, especially with militant forms of Islam, which have threatened Christian communities in many of these places. So I imagine they would tread very carefully on the gay and homosexual issue because it would leave them vulnerable to attack, local attacks in their own countries.
I don't understand why, for paying too much attention to it?
Well, I think it's clear that radical forms of Islam would attack the churches that line up on the gay homosexual issue. You can see why. I mean, the gay and homosexual issue are not really doctrinal issues for Muslims. It's not that there is no gay or homosexual activity in the Muslim community, but it doesn't rise to the level of doctrine the way that the Anglican Church, for example, appears to be doing. And so this would lay open the churches in Muslim countries to accusations of diluting the faith or heresy, in fact. So they're very careful about handling that issue.
Okay. Well, I want to talk some more in a bit about the gap between the church in the West and in other parts of the world. But John Witte, I'd like to know whether you think the issues that are occupying Christian churches now in America, the issues like homosexual unions and gay clergy and other issues around intimate matters, are they embedded in larger questions that are preoccupying Christianity now? I mean, for example, in the case of the gay bishop, he was elected by a congregation in New Hampshire that said they wanted him. So it seems like it's part of another issue about who gets to decide how the church is going to handle these issues.
Certainly today and certainly historically, issues of same-sex union, the criminalization of sodomy, the exclusion of parties for moral turpitude from ordination are all interlinked questions. The issue of same-sex unions that's at stake in the current episcopal debates turns in part upon technical rules of ordination and moral character and the propriety of this particular candidate for his office. It turns in part on hermeneutics or biblical interpretation. How do you account for certain passages in Scripture which seem to, especially in their Levitical form, take fairly firm stands against the acts of homosexual union, though they don't speak to homosexual relations, qua relations. It turns in part upon who has final authority over controversial matters that ripen into internal canon law disputes or the religious law dispute. Is it the convention as a whole? Is it the individual parish or diocese which makes these determinations? When matters are vetted democratically, as they have been in this past convention, does that democratic vetting yield a final resolution to the question, which no longer has an appeal? All of these questions, I think, are very much intertwined, and they cannot be dealt with unless the full theological complexity is untangled and each issue is dealt with I think, due deliberation.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our conversation today is about divisions within Christianity. We're taking a look at the context, both historical context and contemporary global context, in which Christians are debating issues like gay clergy, homosexual unions, other intimate matters. Lanin Sané, I'm wondering if, in light of this larger set of issues that are pertinent to the debates going on in the West, whether those issues have whether they resonate in terms of the gap you identified between West and East, or North and South. I'm not sure quite how to what to call it, but Western Christianity and the rest of the world, I suppose. Yeah. But issues around who has the authority to make decisions and issues around interpretation, are these part of that gap?
Yeah, I think it's not quite clear what the standards of decision-making are, because the democratic process was also at work at Lambeth when the issue of gay and homosexual rights came up there for vote. I have to say here that it was not the third world bishops that wanted to debate the issue. It was the Western bishops. But when it came up for vote, at the insistence of the Western bishops, it was voted down. But immediately the Western bishops responded by saying that the vote, although it was democratic and at their wish, was not binding on them. And so they held themselves under no responsibility to abide by the vote of Lambeth. And so it sort of confuses the issue, and it raises the question, what is the church? The church, in this case, does not really have one authority structure. And in that case, each diocese or each part of the church is autonomous, can make its own decisions without obligation on the part of others who are not part of that diocese or church. But it does raise a very acute question. As long as the Anglican Church was a Western church, an English establishment, and also an American church, then these cultural issues did not really acquire the prominence and the almost sort of really uncompromising character they have as a result of the church now being a world church. There are more Anglicans in Nigeria worshipping Anglicans than there are in Britain, the home of the Anglican Church. There are about 18 million Anglicans in Nigeria alone.
Lanin Sané, we've got to take a break, but when we come back, let's talk some more about the idea of a world church, both an Anglican world church, but also Christianity as a world faith, and a little bit more about what that means to have Christianity shift into other parts of the world. Lots more to come. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Our conversation today is about divisions within Christianity. The selection of a gay bishop in the Episcopal Church in the United States has left some members of that church talking about possibly splitting off, but there are other fault lines within Christianity around the world. We're talking about both the historical and contemporary contexts for these divisions. Our guests today are John Witte, who is a legal historian at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He's the author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in the Western Tradition. He's joining us from Atlanta. From New Haven, Connecticut, we're joined by Lamin Sane, who is a historian of religion at Yale and the author of the forthcoming book, Whose Religion is Christianity? The Gospel Beyond the West. Lamin Sane, I want to talk a little bit more about the idea that Christianity isn't just an English or an American religion anymore. I gather by that you mean something more than just the simple fact that there are people outside of those countries who practice it.
Yes, Christianity has become a global religion or a world religion, although the denominational divisions of Christianity have not allowed us to grasp the significance of that fact. So often you hear Christians talk about the challenge of world religions to Christianity, as if Christianity itself is not a world religion. But it is a world religion, not just in terms of numbers of people, although that is very important to bear in mind, but it is a world religion because of the diversity of languages and idioms and cultures that are now embraced within the Christian tradition. I mean, more people pray and worship in more languages in Christianity than in any other religion in the world. There are today, for example, 2 billion Christians, and 60% of those are outside the West, and the numbers are increasing, not decreasing. So that is why a new fact, a new phenomenon is confronting us. And I think that the cultural wars and the struggles you are seeing over the gay homosexual issue, these things are symptomatic of a much deeper cleavage between the West and the non-Western forms of Christianity.
So, well, John Witte, let me ask you this. As you see these debates over Christianity in the West and over these particular issues within Christianity, do you see them pointing in a particular direction in terms of what kind of a religion Christianity is going to become in the West?
Well, these are merely new catalysts for constant rethinking of both the ecumenical project and the ongoing project of denominational differentiation. I do not see the issue of the ordination of a homosexual bishop to be the whole issue. If the whole question is how does the Christian faith deal with forms and functions and manners and expressions of same-sex desire and union and expression, I see that issue being one that will fracture existing mainline denominations, Catholic and Protestant and Orthodox alike, but I do not see it having the same kind of divisive and schismatic quality that historically issues like slavery and abolition had in mid-19th century, for example, which bitterly divided Protestant denominations between North and South and had ongoing schismatic effect inside several of the denominations thereafter.
Well, what's the difference? I mean, why is it less divisive?
Sheer numbers, in part. Issues of slavery and abolitionism go to the heart of human identity and human dignity, to the heart of the project of human rights of which Christianity has been a vital ally, if not proponent, go to the heart of the love of the other and identity of the other, which issues do come to poignant expression when the travesty of betrayal of those basic ideals which Christianity holds true have been so palpably manifest in the slavery laws of the mid-16th to the mid-19th century. Less of that kind of palpable, routinized legal discrimination with theological warrants has attended the historical discrimination and deprivation of homosexuals. It's not to say that there has not been discrimination and deprivation, sometimes of tragic proportion, to individuals and smaller groups, but it's not of the same order of magnitude, either intellectually or institutionally or theologically.
Okay, so Laman Sané, again, I'm comparing, as people will have noticed by now, what's going on in the United States and those divisions with this larger division that you've identified in the world. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little more about what Christianity is evolving into as it's practiced in all these different languages and in all these different places. I mean, is it turning into a religion that looks substantially different from the type of thing that we see in the West?
Well, yes. I think the gay homosexual issue reflects this very deep cultural process in the West, where the challenge seems to be Christians should try to keep pace with developments in the culture, so that it's the world that is writing the agenda for the church, rather than the church leading the world with its own agenda. In the third world, by contrast, I think what is happening is that new Christian communities are coming into being in situations of incredible pluralism and diversity. And they have to face the fundamental question, what does it mean to be a Christian community in our society, in our culture? These are the fundamental theological questions of identity, of formation, of discernment that these churches are confronted with. And so they are not about to take their orders from the wider culture and sort of say, okay, in India you have a custom, for example, of the infanticide or sati or whatever, and in China you have foot binding. Therefore, if Christians want to be accepted, they better accept these cultural patterns. That's the big difference, it seems to me.
That the church is acting as a bulwark against or an effort to reform the culture, or potentially offer some alternative to the culture as they find it?
Exactly. The church is a kind of trying to synthesize what is there in the old traditions that is wholesome, that is liberating, that is emancipating, and that can be brought into the scope of Christian life and practice in a way that does not undercut the fundamental claims of the gospel. Let's remember that for most Anglicans in Asia and in Africa, the reason for being Anglican at all was because they converted to Anglicanism, if you see what I mean. They were not born into it. These are first generation Christians, or second generation at the most. 60% of the Christians of the world are really under 30 years old. And so they are confronted with major questions of how you position the church in the culture in a way that does not sort of yield the gospel to the terms of the culture, but embraces the culture within the canon of the gospel. Whereas in the West, I think, we've reached a stage now where we can make an easy identity between Christian practice and cultural practice, and we think the two are really synonymous, and you can't really make that assumption in the third world.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and I want to dig in a little more, but before I do that, I want to give people our number. It's 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. We are going to take some phone calls a little later in the program, so give us a call if you'd like to join in. We're talking today about divisions within Christianity, and we were just hearing from Laman Sané, a historian of religion and the author of Whose Religion Is Christianity? The Gospel Beyond the West. And John Witte is with us. He is a legal historian at Emory University and the author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in the Western Tradition. John Witte, as Laman Sané describes this encounter between Christianity and culture in the third world, it doesn't sound that different from some of the debates that take place in the United States, questions about what it's going to mean or what the obligations are of Christians to either accept or reject changes in cultural practice, social mores, the law.
This is an interesting species of a broader controversy that American or North American Christianity has to face, and that is learning the norms and habits of living as a cultural minority, which sounds bizarre, but one thing that Laman Sané's most recent comment underscores is that Christians in the non-West have had to live as a diaspora faith, as a minority faith, living counterculturally and not having the luxury of relying upon local establishments by the state of their cardinal forms and practices of faith and of morality. We in the West, particularly in North America, have had the opposite luxury. They had that luxury of using the state as the mechanism for collecting, codifying, and enforcing basic canons of the faith and of morality that Christianity has held dear. And while that may continue as a pattern for a time, the demographics of American Christianity and the growing diversity of voices that have emerged under the rubric of Christianity make that kind of reflexive majoritarian project a little harder to predict. And the question then becomes, how do Christians anticipate living counterculturally, living as a prophetic faith outside of the mainstream of culture and sometimes swimming against the stream of culture?
Say what you mean by a prophetic faith?
A prophetic faith in the sense of prophesying in the classic biblical sense of the term against actions, beliefs, practices in the culture which are considered to be contrary to the gospel or contrary to the word of God. And Christians can do that by preaching against what it considers to be the legal or moral excesses of the culture around it. But it also can be an example, a prophetic example, by the maintenance of its own internal religious culture and law and the maintenance of a thicker understanding of what marriage and family and sexuality might mean for the voluntary membership that accepts that religious law. And one of the possibilities that is becoming quite real at American law today, given the tradition of federalism, given the tradition of diverse ways of understanding how marriage and family get governed in the individual states. One thing that's beginning to emerge is that religious communities are simply becoming countercultural marital legal cultures in the sense of they're developing their own internal religious laws and practices with respect to marriage formation, maintenance, and dissolution, child care and custody and control, sexual preferences and identities and desires, putting in place certain basic rules that are enforced by internal religious authorities, and simply making adherence to that internal religious law a condition to continued voluntary participation in that community. And that's a start to what may eventually transpire, namely a millet system. What you have in India, what you have in South Africa today, what you had historically in the Ottoman Empire, what you had in the 19th century in the Netherlands, was a circumstance where religious communities were given semi-autonomy over marriage, family, and sexuality, and often education questions, where their voluntary membership would have to hew to that local religious law rather than appeal to the law of the state. And so long as certain principles were not violated, particularly the principle of life and limb, those communities were left alone, and states would defer to those religious communities' adjudication of their own affairs without appeal taken to a secular court. That is beginning to emerge, and one watches what happens in New York with the treatment of Orthodox Jewish communities, the deference that is accorded to rabbinic courts' disposition of cases with respect to divorce. One sees that in some Muslim communities in the Middle Eastern states, where great deference is accorded to internal patterns of Islamic law. One sees that de facto in parts of the West, notably in Utah, where 30,000 polygamous families exist, many with the sanction of the fundamentalist Mormon Church, not the mainline, but the fundamentalist Mormon Church that split off in the 1890s, and live in open violation of criminal laws of bigamy, but the states are deferring to them. That might be one other model besides the traditional model of simply looking to the state by majoritarian impulse to instantiate basic Christian norms that might emerge in the course of the 21st century with some of these questions.
That's a pretty substantial change to think about. Let me give our number once again. It's 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. If you'd like to join in our conversation, give us a call. We're talking about divisions within Christianity, and you are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Lamin Sane, There's so much on the table today. My mind is reeling. But let me ask this. When you talk about the divisions between the concerns of Christians in the third world and the concerns of Christians in the West, are you talking about a gap that eventually could lead to a split, to a formal disconnection between, particularly within the Anglican Communion, which already seems to tolerate a lot of plurality? But I mean, are we looking at something like a schism?
Yes, I mean, that's a very interesting question. And one way to answer that is to say that a schism arises when you have two parties that are equally persuaded and equally grounded in what they regard as the common source of authority, scripture, church tradition, canon law, whatever. In the what is happening today, I do not see a schism arising in that way. Rather, what I foresee, and I think this will happen actually in a matter of few years, maybe a decade, 2 decades, who knows, 30 years, 40 years. What I see is that Western Christianity, or the forms of it that are embraced in kind of liberal Protestantism, will become more and more marginal, will sort of merge with the general culture, so that it would be impossible to distinguish between being a successful businessman or a successful politician in the West and being a leading or prominent churchman. I think the two will become merged, so that the Christian component, in a sense, will become more and more diluted. And that the shift then would be that the center of Christianity, theologically as well as intellectually, will shift to the non-Western world, where people will be engaging the fundamental questions of Christian life and faith. For example, Revelation, the work of Jesus as a healer, having to do work in a universe that is inhabited by the spirits, which the Enlightenment in the West has completely sort of drained, really. It's a small size universe that most Christians in the West live in. A question of divine agency and human agency. Most of us Christians in the West believe that if you're ill, you should go to see a doctor or a hospital and get help. Most Christians in the third world think you should do that too, but you should also go to the church to be prayed for, so that divine agency is actually real and alive in these churches. So I think those shifts will occur, and Christianity, which had been in a stronghold in the West, will become less and less dominant as part of the lives of the people. Already, Christianity is compartmentalized. I mean, it's a very tamed religion in the West. It should not offend. It should embrace. It should tolerate. It should be inclusive, so that its identity is absorbed in the wider culture. That is the shift I see coming up.
Wow. Again, lots to think about. We're going to take a break and think about it and talk about it some more when we come back. We'll take some calls at 1-888-859-1800. If you'd like to join in our conversation about the divisions within Christianity, give us a call. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Our conversation today is about divisions within Christianity, prompted, of course, by the selection of a gay bishop in the Episcopal Church in the United States, an event which caused many members of that church and clergymen within that church to talk about splitting from the church and forming their own church within the larger Anglican Communion. Our guests for this conversation are Lamin Sane, who is a historian of religion at Yale University. He's joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. And legal historian John Witte, who is at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He's the author of From Sacrament to Contract, Marriage, Religion, and Law in the Western Tradition. Our number, which is toll-free, is 1-888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Grant. Hello, Grant. You're on Odyssey.
Yes, thank you. Just a couple of points. One that I think, isn't there like a inherent schism within Christianity itself? Depending if you are a follower of, let's say, the Sermon on the Mount or the Book of Revelations, those are almost two entirely different viewpoints of what Christianity is. And then, like, when they had this controversy going on with the Ten Commandments right now, there's a different Ten Commandments depending if you're Roman Catholic or Southern Baptist or Protestant. I mean, like, they're minor changes, but they're still there. I'm just wondering, that Christianity is set as sort of a schism and, sort of a...
That there's already, comes with its own divisions right in
right.
there. What do you think
right.
about that, John Witte?
Christianity has always been rife with diverse voices, and I think that goes back to the very story of the resurrection experience of Christ. In the aftermath of Christ's resurrection, he's risen from the tomb, and Mary Magdalene comes to the tomb and needs to be called by name. St. Thomas needs to touch the side that was pierced in the nail holes of the cross. St. Peter needed to have a miracle performed for him with the catching of the fish on the other side of the boat. The disciples needed to have their God's Spirit breathed on them. The men from Emmaus needed to have the host lifted for them so they could see the Eucharist. And in my view, the point of that story is to say that God, from the very start in the post-resurrection experience, calls people in different ways and expects different responses to those multiple callings. And from the very start, the church has always had a this centrifugal versus centripetal kind of movement where there's attempts to consolidate certain understandings of the faith that are captured in early apostolic constitutions. There's the canonization of scripture. There's the consolidation of ecumenical creeds. Those movements of consolidation and of regrouping and of seeking to create a higher synthesis have been perennial, but they at the same time have gone on with the movements for growing diversification of the institutions within the church, which sometimes turn upon discrete issues of doctrine, biblical interpretation, interpretation of the commandments, and other things. Christianity is by its very nature a body with multiple parts, with one head called Christ. And these different parts of the body partake of the faith and demonstrate the faith and speak of the faith and write of the faith in multiple ways.
All right, so let's take another call. Let's talk with Dave. Hello, Dave. You're on Odyssey.
As always, Odyssey is fantastic. Great show.
Thank you.
The question I have for both your guests, especially John Witte, is sort of dovetailing on the point you just addressed, the debate over ecumenicalism in mainline Protestantism right now, the sort of two ideas that if we are the church in the world, we should be engaged in the world. We should be working with other denominations to address the ills and evils we see around us. And then the flip side of that, on the more evangelical side, you have phenomenon like the Left Behind books, where people are very focused on the next world and sort of keeping this one at bay, waiting for it to get here. And I know, as in the Lutheran Church, for example, that's a big debate for us. The 9/11 ecumenical religious observance that happened in Yankee Stadium, there was a Lutheran bishop who was actually sanctioned for going. He was said it was a bad thing for him to go and to participate in this joint ecumenical service. So I'm wondering, how do your guests see both the push for and the fear of ecumenicalism affecting the church as it continues to develop here in the United States?
Lamin Sane, let me ask you to address that, because I'd like to know how that question about interdenominational cooperation and engagement as a platform for engagement looks from the perspective of the third world.
Yeah, I mean, one of the features of world Christianity is a profound ecumenical spirit of cooperation and joint witness and joint service. And so the denominational lines in world Christianity are less rigid than they are in the West. Let us remember at Vatican II that it was the third world bishops who insisted that the dogmatic constitution of the Church, which the Western Catholic bishops were going to draw up by making sure that the boundaries are very, very firmly drawn between the Catholic and non-Catholic world. That dogmatic constitution was profoundly changed by the influence of third world bishops, who said that the boundaries of the Church for them are dynamic boundaries. They are moving and shifting boundaries, and they don't want to close the door on new possibilities for the future. So I would say the ecumenical spirit is alive and well, especially in terms of the sentiments people have and in terms of practices. However, I'd like to go back to an issue raised in the earlier question, which is that Christianity, by its very nature, is a pluralist religion. Christianity does not deny difference. After all, the apostles were very aware of the fact that there were, if you like, differences and different talents, many members in one body, as it were, with different functions. And Paul developed this idea in a very eloquent way. Unfortunately, through historical acculturation, Christianity became fascinated with the idea of a monarchical form of the faith with a hierarchical setup where all the authority was vested in one center. But as we know from Roman Catholicism, even the Vatican is not able to dictate what happens everywhere in the Catholic Church. So I think we have to recognize that Christianity has been an engine, a promoter of diversity and difference in the world. Rather than be afraid of this, we should embrace and celebrate difference. And as far as the ecumenical movement is concerned, I think one of the ways it went wrong in the 1960s and 70s was to look for a bureaucratic expression of the faith without regard to local particularity and local expressions.
All right, we're getting sort of near the end of our time, so I want to take some more calls before we run out of time. Let's talk with Matt. Hello, Matt, you're on Odyssey.
Hi, I wanted to ask if maybe the problem with gay marriage between the East and the West isn't so much a difference in religious doctrine, but more a difference in the way, I mean, the West has changed its idea of what marriage is, and maybe the East hasn't yet made that shift from a contract between families or between men to a sort of voluntary joining of equal partners.
John Witte, I'm going to let you address that, although it would seem like a question for Laman Sane. You're the one who's actually looked at this evolution of marriage and its contractual nature.
There's no question that the driving engine intellectually for the rise of gay rights and for the agitation for same-sex marriages comes outside of religious doctrine and is driven by some of the libertarian moves of the Enlightenment Project. Christianity is, in its definition of marriage from the second and third centuries, has always identified marriage as a heterosexual monogamous union between two fit adults, and after the 12th century it was added capable of consent of themselves independent of their families. That basic definition and the form of the marital unit which is presupposed continues from the 12th century until the mid-20th century, and it's only in the course of the reforms driven by Enlightenment calculus of libertarianism, egalitarianism, and concerns of privacy, which get captured at constitutional law, does the definition of marriage in the culture around Christianity, and sometimes by acquiescence, the culture of marriage within Christianity, get thinned out to a confectionary bilateral contract between two fit parties who choose to be together and whose third-party beneficiaries are their children. If you thin marriage out to those, that narrowest understanding of bilateral contract, if you provide opportunities for unilateral exit from that contract, which is not presupposed in many other contracts. And when you make the ceremony that attaches to that union at state law be the mere procurement of a license, it's very easy to see that the logic of those reforms would dictate that then the form of marriage itself should be open to private negotiation.
I need to jump in here for a second and give our number again. It's 1-888-859-1800. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. So, Lamin Sani, let's follow up with the other half of the question, which was the suggestion that this issue is not of concern to Christians in other parts of the world because marriage is just thought of differently, and so the question of gay marriage isn't on the agenda.
Yes, I mean, I think that is true. The way we have compartmentalized life in the West into little compartments, and each compartment is a sort of autonomous, a little circle that is complete in itself. But if you take the claims of Christianity, it is very difficult if you are a convert to Christianity to say, well, there are certain parts of my life that really don't belong with my faith, and I must remove them. Now, of course, in the third world, these Christians are confronted with basic fundamental questions about new forms of community, new forms of identity, new forms of solidarity. So, and they have a religious worldview. I'm talking about divine agency. They actually believe that God exists, that God is real, that God rules the world, and that God has a direct role to play in their lives. And so they haven't really got to the point that we have reached in the West of saying, well, there are certain parts of my life that, you know, God has nothing to do with, and I must exclude God from whole sections of my life, or I must admit God exactly how I want to admit God, where I feel God should be introduced. So it's a kind of voluntarist notion of religion and faith that really is very much a reflection of Western culture.
It's interesting, though, we just have a couple minutes left, but John Witte, it seems like that notion that Lamin Sani is describing, that kind of relationship between a person's life and their faith, sounds much more like the kind of minority religion view that you were suggesting Christianity might become even in the West. Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't. I'm a legal historian, forgive me. Spell it out for me.
Okay, that if Christianity in the West becomes a minority religion, that it then becomes more, it returns to being more of a life system distinct from the culture, that in other words, which would shape your interaction with the culture rather than just disappearing into the culture in the way that it has now.
That would be one consequence of becoming a minority faith. I mean, to remain a minority faith and to withstand the inevitable temptations to assimilation, faiths must become more fervent in their convictions and oftentimes more deliberate in developing their own internal legal processes to survive. That's one of the ironic side effects of being a minority, and especially being a repressed minority. It does have a Darwinian effect. There's another side to the East-West story, though, that it's the West versus non-West of Christianity is a two-way street. Yes, there have been Western understandings of Christianity that have come on the heels of the missionaries, about which Professor Sana has written so brilliantly, and that there has been a constant negotiation between that Westernized, missionized form of Christianity and the local culture, which seeks to embrace it, and there's inevitable enculturation, assimilation, and revision and reform that occurs there as a consequence. But there's a reverse phenomenon, too, with the rise of immigration, with the growing globalization, the growing ease of access, both through travel and through internet and through literature and telephone and other kind of technical means. There is a growing revivification of the Western Church and of Western Christianity by the influx of these ideas and sometimes persons from non-Western venues of Christianity. And I think that has been happy. It has not only reinvigorated some of the doctrinal purity and moral suasion and prophetic ambition of the church, but it has also fructified the church with new ideas, new practices, sometimes challenging, sometimes very edifying. And I think the new immigrant Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox sitting in the pew in America is going to have a profound effect on acting exactly in the opposite direction of simple assimilation,
right,
which we have talked about.
We'll have to wrap it up there. John Witte is a legal historian at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He joined us from Atlanta. Lamin Sane is a historian of religion at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Lamin Sane and John Witte, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Gretchen, for having us.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under General Manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marge Ostrushko. Funding for the program is provided by a generous grant from the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.